The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
You wrote, quote, "Memory matters, no matter how skewed," end quote. Why do you believe that?
I believe that because so many of us live a good part of our lives in memory. We identify ourselves through memory.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Onyx Smith about her memoir, Crossing the Plains with Bruno. This is a book about a road trip you took from Missoula County in Montana to Sawyer, Michigan, where you spent time with your mother at the family's cottage. And as the title suggests, your dog Bruno went along. Tell us about Bruno.
Bruno was this great big 95-pound chocolate lab that I got from my granddaughter, Jessie, when he was a pup. And he was a quite remarkable dog, a very funny dog. It was as though he had a sense of humor and knew it. And he was also terribly affectionate, and he would jump into people's laps, and that was a surprise when a 95-pound dog jumps into your lap. Bruno was a great companion because he was so sweet and so funny and so idiosyncratic. I mean, you couldn't really tell what he was going to do next. And I loved him, and I wanted to do this road trip and thought that being with a dog would be perfect. You didn't have to have a conversation with a dog except in dog terms. And he would force me to go out and take, you know, rest stops and walks and pees and so on every so often, which put me back in the real world, you know, outside of my car. Bruno was 4 when this trip took place, and that was sort of at the height of his powers.
It must have been a little bit of a comfort to have a large animal with you when you were driving through strange places and getting out and taking walks.
It was a great comfort. I mean, it was a comfort and a stimulation, and you had somebody to care for and care about, and somebody to care for you, you know, because he would want to nuzzle me and lick me, and he was very much there. He was right behind me. I made a big dog bed out of pulled the seats down in the 4Runner, and so he was had a big dog bed, and it could nuzzle up to my neck and so on. He loved new places, so every place we went was new and exciting, and he sort of led me into them by his excitement and his senses.
Well, let's hear a short passage. It's one in which you describe the beginning of the trip. But first, I'll say that Steve is one of your 4 sons and that Bill is your life partner, William Kittredge.
That's correct. Okay. May 11th, my 67th birthday and Mother's Day, arrive sun-swept and blooming. The meadow is speckled with magenta shooting stars and yellow dogtooth violets. I don't want to budge from my home and my family, but my mother is impatient for me to deliver her from the old people's high rise, where she lives on Chicago's north side, to our beach house in Michigan. So, to transform duty into adventure, I decide to try out the white secondhand 98 Toyota 4Runner I have just purchased from my eldest son Eric for $13,000, a bargain. But I am uneasy about this new rig. SUV is a dirty word to environmentalists like me, and after 30 years of Subarus, I feel like a traitor. No guilt, Mom, says Steve, boyish despite his 45 years. SUVs are made for people like you, not housewives in Martha Stewart land. Or armchair adventurers. Bill laughs his trademark laugh, low-pitched and expansive. He is a travel book addict who loves maps and sea stories and guides to deepest Paraguay, where he ventures only in the imagination. What I love is to head down the road into new territory and discover whatever comes to me. It has been 17 years since I'd driven across the plains alone, and I am antsy with anticipation. No matter how much I talk about wanting to stay put, don't believe me, I'm a nomad at heart. The road calls, but I want privacy, not loneliness, which is why Bruno will be my perfect traveling companion. Bill follows my dust from Bear Creek Road to Highway 200, where he will turn west and I will turn east. It is late afternoon, a strange time to begin a cross-country trip, but I want to jump-start the voyage and get myself into road rhythm. Be careful, he says. I throw a kiss from my car window to Bill's, watch his Honda disappear, and take out my brand new journal. Usually, I'm too lazy to keep a journal. I try from time to time, believing a writer should, and upon rereading, am appalled by my mundane mind. But when I'm on a voyage of discovery, journaling is useful. I enter the date, 5/11/03, mileage, 84,561, and time of departure, 4:20 p.m. I want to keep track of where I go, spontaneously driving toward sunrise across what used to be called the Great American Desert.
This is a book about a trip, but it's also a book about you and your family. Was it challenging to decide what to include and what to leave out?
It was terribly challenging, and it took me a long time, you know, 6 or 7 years of experimenting. It was largely free association. I had kept a journal, so I knew where I went, and I had some thoughts sprinkled in there about what I was thinking. And I took snapshots, so I had a pictorial record of where I'd been. And I didn't think of writing the book until several years after the journey, actually, when my mother died 3 years later. So then I just began to piece it together, trying to use the journey as the spine, and my memories and my thoughts and my present, you know, experience of place as markers along the road. It's kind of like a picture puzzle putting it together.
What did your sons think of the parts that included them?
Well, nobody has really screamed at me. I think that sometimes they think it's correct. Sometimes they think I've got the story wrong. Sometimes they have, you know, their own separate memories, which I think should be honored because we all kind of make up our memories to define who we are. But I think generally they're pretty proud that I've done it and like it.
They each have their own way of thinking about whatever they're reading in your book, I'm sure.
That's for sure. They've always had their own way about everything.
Well, you raised them right. So you were born in France, and you grew up in Chicago.
That's right.
So how did you end up in Montana? What's the Cliff Notes version of that saga?
I'll try and make this short. I married when I was 19 to David Smith and immediately had my first son, Eric. And then we came to Seattle. He was a lawyer at the time. And we drove to Seattle and lived there for 6 years. And I had another child in between. And he practiced law, and then he got discouraged with it. And we became friends with Dick Hugo. And Dick Hugo, the poet, came to Montana in 1964 to teach at the university. And Dave was just finishing his PhD in English literature at the time. And he said, why don't you apply for a job? So Dave did. And we got here. And he got the job, and that's how I came to Montana.
And you ended up on some land. I'm thinking the 60s and 70s, there was kind of a back to the land movement going on. And did you get caught up in that, or was that always your intention?
I don't think it was always our intention, although, you know, Dave was fatally sick at the age of 35. He found that out. And we got here several years before that. But I think it became important for him and for us to find a place to live, to build a house, and to kind of plant ourselves in the soil. So I always thought it was his idea, and I followed. But I learned that actually he was thinking about me and the boys having a permanent place, a place that we loved, after he was gone, because he knew he would go. So we looked and looked and finally found the perfect place up the Blackfoot off of Bear Creek Road, which is where I still live. We moved there in 1971, and I'm still there.
Your career as a filmmaker began with a job offer that wasn't yours. Say how that happened and tell us why you accepted that job.
David had been a lawyer, was an English professor, and then got sick, and he had wanted to become a filmmaker. And so we went to L.A. and tried that out for a few months, and it was a failure, and we came home. We had, in the meantime, made a movie about Dick Hugo called The Lady in Kicking Horse Reservoir, just a black and white half-hour voiceover film. And we had started writing grants for other things we wanted to make movies about. And one was a story about the Nez Perce Indians, which we sent to KSPS-TV, public radio, public television in Spokane. And they liked it, but they couldn't get funding for it. What they did get funding for was a series about the seven tribes of the Inland Northwest, a more contemporary kind of a documentary series. And they called in July of 1974 to offer Dave the job as the producer and me to be the associate producer. Well, Dave had died in May. And so I told the station manager that, and he said, well, how about you? And I said, oh, no, I couldn't do that. I've never done any producing of a TV series, and I'm not sure I'm ready. And he said, well, come and interview. And I did. And they liked me, and they offered me the job. And I was deep in grief at the time and without a job or without any income. The income was good. The job was a challenge. And I would have to move to Spokane, but I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to take my kids with me. The twins were 6 years old. The two older boys were in high school. They just lost their father. And I was pretty sure that I wouldn't work out in this job, that it would be a failure. So I left them at home in the care of friends, and I commuted back and forth to Spokane every weekend. I would come home every weekend for the first year. And the second year I was there, I brought the twins with me. And Eric had graduated from high school, and Steve was a junior, and he wanted to stay. And anyway, he stayed, and I did the job, and it was tough going, and it was a big education for me. And working with an all-Indian crew, and we did a 9-part series called The Real People, which is available, I think, on YouTube right now. And it was broadcast around the country. So that was the start of my film career. It was a hard decision, but I wanted to become a filmmaker, and this was a big opportunity. And it started me on a whole path of my own. I think my children had to pay some of the price of me being gone for those 2 years or being so deeply engaged in movies. But it must have stuck at least with the twins, because they ended up being filmmakers themselves and just, you know, directed and wrote their version of Winter in the Blood. So maybe what you do when you're a child has a real lasting effect. They went to lots of powwows. They went to lots of Indian reservations when they were 7. So that stuck.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Onyx Smith about her memoir, Crossing the Plains with Bruno. If you missed part of the program, you can hear it again online. It's available as a podcast, also at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about how writing or telling stories helps with life transitions. Don't go away. Thank you. were in your 60s when you did this trip, and you were in your 70s when you wrote the book. So there's a lot of contemplation about people living and people dying. And while you were at your mother's cottage or your family's cottage in Michigan, Bill's brother, Pat, died. And you remembered him in a passage which takes place on page 143. And I'd like you to read that.
Okay, Pat was a dear friend, and of course this book is filled with loss because I'm almost 80 years old, and by that time you lose lots of people. Pat loved to come to the ranch for dinner, to sit on our deck in the warm seasons, smoking and drinking gin and tonics with Bill. I have snapshots of Pat leaning back in a red metal chair. He resembles his father, Oscar, who also preferred that chair. We would dip chips into salsa and look out at grazing cattle or down the canyon where Bear Creek runs through timbered slopes toward the Blackfoot River. It must have reminded those men of the MC Ranch in eastern Oregon that each had left behind, but only a little. "You call this Jack Pine Flat a ranch? There's nothing worth calling a ranch in all of western Montana," says Bill, with the pride of a dispossessed prince. The ranch the brothers grew up on ran to thousands of acres of plowed meadows planted with grains. Its irrigated marshlands harbored white pelicans in head-high grass, and the miles of high, arid sagebrush prairies they leased from the BLM were rimmed by buttes where antelope multiplied in herds of prehistoric dimensions. As boys and young men, Bill and Pat harvested grain by the boxcar load, drank beer with the hired hands, and drove cattle across the desert like the horseback cowboys they were. That Western youth stamped Pat indelibly, as it stamped Bill. But Bill could bring the ranch back in stories and essays. Pat had no such release. He couldn't go home to his lost ranch and family, and he couldn't settle down.
I really like this idea that Bill could bring the ranch back by writing it down. And, you know, even if somebody isn't a writer, they can tell stories. Have you noticed that writing or telling stories aloud helps people navigate big transitions in their lives?
I think we live by telling stories, and those stories change as we change, of course. There's no solid story of who we are or what we do. But it helped me a lot to deal with my grief of my mother's death and before her my father's death and David's death, David Smith, my husband, to try and write him down. And writing it down kind of objectifies the event. And you become engaged, if you are me, in the art of writing as well as the memory. So that makes it easier to understand what happened. It makes it easier to digest it and takes away some of the immediacy, some of the stress, I think. Although it brings it back whenever you look at it and read it, but it's back in your own words, in your own time. I think it helps to write things down, to tell stories about what happens to you. They become part of the world in some kind of a way. And you go out of yourself when you're doing that, not into yourself.
And yet it's kind of a reflection back to yourself, and then something that someone else can read and reflect on or hear.
Well, that's the value of anybody writing, particularly nonfiction, particularly memoir, is that nobody really cares about your life. You know, they really don't care. But they care about their lives. And if you can stimulate the imaginations, the heart, the memory of your readers or listeners to reimagine their own stories, if you can help them to reimagine their own stories in a positive way, in a deepening way, that is the value of writing it down in the first place.
You wrote about your parents leaving their homes to reinvent themselves. They were both born in Europe. And you noted that they didn't realize that they were leaving their children, in your words, bereft of historical identity. And I thought maybe that was part of the reason you felt a need to tell your story, to leave some historical trace.
That's probably true. I mean, my parents, who were Hungarian Jews and had gone to Paris and then come to the United States, they didn't want to talk about the old country, especially my father. My mother was a storyteller. She liked to tell stories, but my father wouldn't. And I think this is true of many immigrants who come to a country and want to assimilate. They wanted to be Americans. They wanted to have an American story, and they wanted us to be Americans. And so, you know, other people can trace their family history in a place or something through a long period of time. We couldn't. We had only our parents and our near relatives, grandparents and uncle and aunt and cousins, to create a community based on the old country. So we always felt that we needed those stories. And so actually my sisters and I went back to Hungary and to Serbia and Transylvania, where my ancestors came from, trying to find their graves in Jewish graveyards, which was quite another story, maybe another book.
You were able to pull some of that history back into these pages. You'll leave this for your kids.
Right. And of course, they will have their own versions of a lot of these stories, and then they can compare and laugh or critique or whatever, but they, at least there's some kind of record to go from.
I want to end with one more short reading from the preface of the book, but first I want to give you a chance to say anything about the book that you haven't said.
You know, it's an odd book. It combines all these elements of my love of the West and road tripping in the West, dogs. At one point, I had written stories about all the dogs I ever had and had to cut out all but Bruno, and at the very end, my current black lab companion, Lulu. And it is about memory. It's about my memory of myself as a child, about my parents and their ancestors. I think it's particularly important right now because we have this whole refugee immigrant crisis in the world. And people are so anti-immigrant, but we are all immigrants. I am actually a first-generation immigrant. And I think we need to open our hearts and our minds and show empathy for these people who are homeless and need homes.
And just for anyone who's ever gone on a road trip, don't you find that your mind just starts digging around and finding things to think about that you hadn't thought about ever?
I love driving across the West, particularly the West, in vehicles. And I love doing it alone or nearly alone, because it is such a wonderful way to meditate. That place sparks all kinds of ideas and memories and thoughts, and then you're back in the real place in real time. So I think for me, it's a great, great way to get away from the hustle and bustle of every day, get away from cell phones, although some people don't, I wish they would. Listen to some music, hear some poetry, just look out the window and daydream. Of course, keeping your eyes on the road.
But a lot of the places you drove, there wasn't a lot of traffic, so you could just kind of cruise along and let your mind go.
That's for sure. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of the West. It's still there, it's still open, it's still pretty empty compared to the rest of the country.
Okay, so the very tail end of the preface is what I want you to read.
Bruno is the dog star of this story, and essential to my narrative. While driving across the vast spaces of the interior West, I often got lost in memory or flights of fancy. Bruno's presence and his needs forced me to return to the actual. He reminded me that I, too, am an animal whose existence depends on being alert to the scents and sights and hungers and emotions of the moment. Through constant company in an enclosed space, I had hoped to inch closer to understanding this dog's way of being, observing my mysterious animal as the cave people observed theirs, fascination with animals being as old as our species, and the inspiration for our first and perhaps greatest expressions in art. I only partially succeeded. I learned that dogs have memories, instincts, fears, moods, loyalties, and hatreds. They are like us in those ways. But as far as I know, dogs do not get swept up in nostalgia, speculation, or self-analysis, and although they have hopes, they are not driven by regrets. Which is why, in a story narrated by a woman beset by the processes of aging and the imminence of death, the dog who rides shotgun is, like Sancho Panza to Don Quixote, a reminder of the physical realities outside our imaginations. He is a connoisseur of scent trails that branch sideways or backward, uphill or down, always serpentine from any straight path. I cannot know what advice Bruno would have offered if he were instructing me about how to write this book, but I'd like to think he would tell me to follow my nose. Life, he might say, bounds like furtive, delicious rabbits across every step of our way. Heading toward 80, it is easy to fall into stories about nostalgia and loss, but the world I encounter is as new and present as everyone's. In the pages that follow, I have put together a mix of travel and relationship, Western history and family history, human love and animal love that centers around the 2 weeks I took to visit my mother. It is a chain of linked meditations, often triggered by place, about how the past impinges on the present and how that present can exist seemingly sans past. Like everyone, I arrange memories, sensations, and thoughts in stories to define myself and those I love. Then I discover those stories are unstable and changing and filled with surprises, but there is consistency in them, the singular voice. I speak for myself, but as any character in my stories will tell you, I cannot see life whole or true, so experience reinvented will have to suffice. One twist of the kaleidoscope at memory's core causes the shards to fragment and repattern, but they are always the same shards. Now I see triangles and deep blue holes. Tomorrow there may be butterflies. That is how I believe stories work. They must be both startling and predictable, like every day's dawn.
Onyx Smith lives near Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.